Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of A Place in the Conversation. My name is Dan Neiswanger. I'm the spiritual formation catalyst for A Place in the Conversation. And I'm very glad to have Nick Everhart and Dan Fetch with us today. So, Nick, why don't you introduce yourself, say a few words.
Sure. So I'm Nick Everhart. I'm sort of a Dan's wingman, and I was a member of First Baptist Church, and Dan and I have had a lot of interesting conversations. I know that talking with him provides a safe place, and so that's what we're trying to create here.
Good. Thank you, Nick. And so, Dan, you know, you and I, over the years, you and I have had hours of conversations. And, you know, when I was a pastor at First Baptist Church, I had this policy that if my door was open, then that meant that anybody and everybody could walk in and say hello, sit down and talk. And, you know, and if my door was closed, that meant I was working on something and I needed a little bit of privacy. But you were one of the people who really took advantage of the open door policy. You came in and we would just sit, for hours sometimes and just have amazing conversations. So I'm thrilled that you're joining us here today. And so we can kind of, you know, capture a little bit of those conversations. So Dan, why don't you introduce yourself to everybody and share a little bit of your story.
Okay, well, I'm Dan Fetch, and yes, I met Pastor Dan here at this church. I go to a meeting here every day at noontime, 6 days a week it meets here, and it is a recovery meeting. And I've been in recovery, alcohol and drugs, for 26 plus years, and I've been sober all that time. And I find that going to meetings on a regular basis is one of the key factors there. And what I've learned from the program is to how to give freely, all right? And I never knew that growing up. Giving freely was not something I was taught as a kid, not something society teaches you. Quid pro quo is what you're taught. All right, what's in it for me? You know, let's see what I do. You know, somebody needs to do something back for me. And I never knew that the joy of life and the true meaning of life is to be able to give freely. And the rewards that come from that are tenfold, all right, beyond anything that I knew existed. And in meeting Dan and spending time with Dan has been some of the greatest, you've been a spiritual counselor for me, all right? Been able to speak, you know, I believe in Jesus Christ as my Savior, and that's not a necessity in recovery, but some sort of higher power that you believe in and firmly believe in is, all right? And the solution to the drug and alcohol problem is a spiritual solution, and it's that simple. You must put your faith somewhere other than in humans and in yourself, because that you know, there is going to be a time when that's all you have. The only connection you're going to have between you and death is that power greater than yourself. And again, when I I grew up, my father's an alcoholic, and it was a pretty chaotic life. All right, five kids. Father that came home drunk. He was the typical Jekyll Hyde. And Mr. Hyde was who came home, all right, 7-8 o'clock at night after being in a bar from the time he left work. And usually the police were there, and, you know, eventually in fights, and I'd be hiding under my bed as a kid and, you know, just listening to that and feeling somehow or another that I was responsible for a lot of it. All right. And those are ugly things, and things that I, you know, the pains of growing up that way. One would think you'd always want to avoid being an alcoholic after that. But all it did for me was gave me a benchmark of what an alcoholic is. And I'll never be that bad. And eventually in my 40s, I became a father, and, 42. Didn't want to have any kids before that, and I was married for 13 years at that point. And the reason why is because I didn't want to be my father to that child. And I wasn't willing to stop drinking. And, you know, that was a part of my life, my persona. And I managed to be productive. And we were just talking about this earlier, about this notion of a functioning alcoholic, which is a non-existent. It's an oxymoron. There is no such thing if you're an alcoholic. If you're drinking every night or, you know, even just on weekends, all right, you have a problem. And if you're trying to control your drinking or know that you're not drinking, all right, if I would stop, I'd stop drinking for my wife's sake or for, you know, a condition's sake, you know, going to college at night. I did that, and, you know, I'd be able to behave myself, but I always knew that I was controlling my drinking. All right. It was always there in my mind that, you know, oh, I'm not drinking this week. You know, I'm not drinking until Friday. And then when Friday would come, all the stops would be out, and it would be a wild weekend and, you know, a lot of misery and pain that I'd cause, and mostly with myself, but, you know, certainly with other people. And that went on for years. So my son was born. He was the greatest experience of my life, all right? My wife was 37, I think, at that time, and 36. And so she was on the high risk, you know, getting close to that. And we decided, you know, our relationship was getting kind of shaky. Figured the best thing we could do to fix that was to have a child. And so it happened right away, and fortunately for us. And but as she got closer to her due date, she got gestational diabetes, and they decided that 10 days early, they weren't gonna start putting her on insulin, so we went in to do a C-section. It was kind of a shock because we were expecting to have another 10 days. And so we went in the hospital, and the C-section was there. I was there, watched the whole thing, which I'm fine with. And it was the most incredible experience of my life, all right, watching my son come out of there and cry. And I had spoke to him every day, every night in her belly, all right. So he recognized my voice right away. And when he came out, the doctor, you know, when they put him in the nursery, and I had to leave finally. And I went in the nursery, and all these kids were screaming in there. It was about 10 kids in there. And I came in and asked for my son, who's my name, all right, Dan Fetch. And they said, oh, him, he's the one that's got all these guys crying. And I went over. As soon as I talked to him, he shut up. He knew exactly who I was, all right. And my wife, after the surgery, went into the recovery suite, and I was in there. I went in there with her, and her blood pressure started to go extremely high. All right, she was feeling terrible, and I called the doctors over, and they pushed me out of the way and started pumping her up with all kinds of drugs. She had post-toxemia and almost died, and but she was fine, all right, but she couldn't take care of the baby. So I stayed in the hospital for the next 4 days, and I did everything with them, including the, well, all kinds of things. But I fed him, and I took care of him, and so I had this great bond with him. And, you know, this was a solution to my drinking problems and my other problems, which I didn't see as a problem, really. All right, it was still a solution for me, all right? It was the only thing that I was finding that gave me peace, all right? The only time I found solace was you know, and that when I first started to drink, I would get a good feeling, and then, but it always went too far, and I'd pass out, and come to, when I'd come to, it'd be hell. All right, the four horsemen would be in the room with me, and it was just gloom and doom, you know, impending doom for the next day, and the misery and shame of the day before, and the promise that I'm not going to do it again tomorrow. And by the end of the day, I couldn't wait. I forgot all about that. Could not wait to get relief again, and that was my release. So here I am on my son, and this was a solution, all right? And things got so much better at home. And but it didn't last. And about a year into it, year and a half into it, I had a very stressful job situation. And I had to be traveling every day to North Jersey from, you know, Southeast Pennsylvania. And it was horrible. And so I was pretty miserable by the time I got home. I couldn't wait to, you know, just get done my obligations at home and get to my man cave and, you know, do my drinking and get my release. And end up passed out, you know, on the couch, coming to with the dog next to me, the TV on, and by myself and the same four horsemen in that room. And just impending doom. And like I said, on the outside, things looked pretty good. People thought I had a good life, and I did not. Inside, I wanted to kill myself. And the solution became that. All right, I started to realize that I couldn't fix me. All right, the God that I had been introduced to as a child, I heard the Ten Commandments, if, you know, I heard all that, and if you, you know, if you even thought these things, you've committed them, and there's no, you know, this was not a forgiving God that I was introduced to as a youth, all right? It was in a Lutheran church. My father was he was a hero in the church. He was the organ player. He was one of a small group of people that could play these huge church-filled, pipe organs, and had been invited to play at like eight different one churches all around the world because he was, a master at that. He was a choir leader, chorus leader, and, everybody at church said, you know, you're so lucky to have a father that this, but they didn't know the monster that was at home that we saw all the rest of the week. And so I saw the hypocrisy in church and things that didn't make sense. So I couldn't bond with that. And I never felt a loving God in that church. And so my thoughts were that I guess I just don't really believe in God, but I wasn't an atheist or an agnostic, all right? I was just, mixed up and had not understood, you know, I hadn't felt the love of God, hadn't realized that God had been looking after me the whole time. And, all the things that I had gotten into in my youth that should have killed me, and, I should have spent time in jail, all those things, it didn't happen. None of that ever happened. And thought it was me. I thought I was a very good drunk driver. I thought I was a good talker, get myself out of things, all those things. And a self-made man, that's what I always considered myself. My mother died when I was 17, cancer, and my father was thrown out of the house when I was 11. So my mother had her own business, so I had no direction or no guidance, no parenting, pretty much. And so I had really, now I have a son, I have no parenting skills. I have no examples of good parenting. So, I had an older brother. He was the closest thing I could pick on from there. And he had lots of issues. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he had a lot of other issues. And he did do a lot of drinking. He was a heavy drinker. So I'm kind of getting all over the place here. But so my son, all right, and where I am with that, my family, my solution, all right, had come to a point where I couldn't understand the God that I didn't believe in. I was praying to and saying, why am I existing? What is the purpose of my life? You know, this is horrible. You know, this is day after day living like this was hell. The willpower I had was incredible to keep living that way. And, and still go to work and still maintain, you know, this front, this fake person, all right? And and not being able to talk to anybody about it. Nobody, I couldn't tell anybody where I was. I wasn't willing to surrender to anything. You know, I was still thinking I had some way or another I was in control or had control, which I did not. And my life was unmanageable, all right, put it that way. And I had a two-year suicide clause in the life insurance policy that I bought when my son was born, and he became two, and I realized that the solution for his life and my wife's life, the best thing I was going to do for them was to kill me, and they'd have the money to pay for his college education, pay off the house, and everything would be okay in their life, and they'd be way better off than with me as a father and me in that house. And so that thought became a plan finally. And my wife sensed that, and my family had an intervention. And in that intervention, they told me lots of good things about me and, you know, all these things that I didn't believe. And it was just noise. And but they wouldn't leave until I called this guy. And this guy was from AA, and they weren't going to leave until I called this guy. And so I did. I called this guy, and he asked me if I was drinking, and I said, yeah, but I'm not drunk. And he said, can you not drink between now and 9 o'clock tomorrow morning and call me? I thought about it, and I said, yeah, but why would I? And he didn't answer that. He just started telling his story. And in his story, he told me about how his father had a business that he had worked in, and he took it over. He ran it into the ground, and a bunch of people lost jobs because of it that had been lifelong employees there. And he had a family. He had two boys and a house, and everybody thought, you know, he was a good businessman and all these other things. He's had this front going on. And inside, he wanted to kill himself because he figured that was the solution. And he had a suicide clause in his life insurance policy. And he thought that that would be the best thing he could do for his family. And I'm thinking, how did this guy know that that's what I, you know, where did that come from? Because I never told anybody this. And but I just, he wouldn't stop talking. So I just said, okay, I'll not drink between now and 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I'll call you. And I went back to my man cave and chased my family out of there. They were asking me, are they going to come get you and all these other things. I said, no, I'm going to call this guy tomorrow. That's it. And got him out of there. And I sat down on my couch with my half a gallon of vodka, my 357, and my my warm beer there. And I looked, had my head in my hands for a while, thinking about what just had happened. And the only feelings I can remember were being embarrassed and mad at my wife. Nothing else. And not really thinking much about this conversation that I had with this guy. But I had put his number down on the table. And I went to reach for my beer, and I saw that number. And I said, no, I told this guy I wouldn't drink, and I'd call him tomorrow. And I really wouldn't have cared about that, because I would lie about my drinking to anybody. Nobody was going to tell me not to drink. And I didn't drink that night. And moments later, my wife came down the steps with my son in her arms. He had been sleeping. She had been crying. And she just stood there looking at me. I looked at her. I wasn't going to say anything. I didn't know what she was going to say. And she said, if you kill yourself, we're never going to forgive you. And I got a chance to look at myself, for a glimpse of myself from their eyes, see how selfish I was and where I was. And she turned around and went back upstairs, and I didn't drink that night, and that was the last drink I had.
So Dan, as you tell this story, this is not the first time I've heard this story, right? You and I have shared a lot. And you know, I remember the first time you shared this story with me. Part of my reaction was, this is not the Dan I know, right? Like, this is like the Dan I know is somebody who is just so full of life and is at the drop of a hat. Like, I can't count the number of times that I've had somebody call you, or I called you and said, hey Dan, could you call somebody who I know is struggling right now? And you, at the drop of a hat, are gonna do that. And so at the beginning of your story, you know, you talked about this, the difference of the language I would use would be being like self-focused and then looking at and caring about other people. So how did that, like, that's a piece, right, of the transformation mm-hmm. that has taken place in you. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
So talk about that for a minute. What does it mean for you to be focused on others, and how does that heal? Because so many of us, like myself included, right, we all carry burdens, we all carry guilt, we carry shame, we've all been wounded in the past by people, places, and things. And we all carry those wounds from the past, and we're searching for healing for those things. And I think so much of it has to do with whenever we take ourselves out of the picture and we stop looking at ourselves and we look at others. And so how does that work for you?
So one story I'll give you is I had a family reunion we'd have every year. One of my uncles and was in up by Harrisburg, and so they had a lake house, and we'd always go, and it'd be a big drinking fest for everybody. It was just, you know, one of these relationships. And every time I'd go to anything, my concern was for myself, you know. Was I going, you know, how was this going to work for me? You know, what was, you know, it was all about, because I was so self-centered in the extreme. And I was concerned. I had only a couple months sobriety, and I was nervous about this, you know. What am I going to do there, you know? What about me? You know, what's my role here? You know, how am I going to feel and all this other thing? And I had learned a lot more about myself and about how to behave. And I said, you know, I'm always thinking about me. Why don't I think about somebody else when I go there? And I said, you know what I'm going to do to occupy myself and to keep myself out of my own head is I'm going to pick somebody out that nobody talks to, one of my relatives. And I had an aunt. Aunt Esther, all right, that she was just a curmudgeon, and she took care of us one point when we were kids. I think she lived in Reading. I think it was in Reading. And nobody spent much time with her. They took care of her, made sure she had what she needed, but she would set her up and that was it. And I said, you know, I've never really talked to this woman. She probably has a lot to say. She knew my mother more than anybody else, more than I know. She can tell me a lot of things about my family too. So I went in there and I focused on her. I sat down and I talked to her, and we had a great conversation. And she told me all kinds of things about my mother. And before I knew it, the kids came in. There was kids there playing, and I was playing with them for a while with her while I was talking to her. And my wife comes in and says, are we going to leave? It's time to go. I had no idea the time would pass that quickly. And I realized that the gift, the truth, was that, you know, I needed to learn how to give to others and focus on others, not me. And then I'd be taken care of. And I found that to be exactly what I do now, right, in AA. I had learned that by going to AA meetings, and, you know, I used to hear all the time people would say, the reason why I come to AA meetings is to keep me sober. And I said, well, that's a pretty selfish reason to come, right? But it's a valid reason. And I thought that was okay. And I came to realize that, how does that work? And I realized that I needed to come to meetings to help other people. And when I focused on other people, all right, I was taken care of, and who was doing that but God? And, there's a lot of other terms in there. There's, something in our literature, there's at one point where it says we need to decide that either God is everything or God is nothing, and we have to make that choice. And I had been, you know, graveling with this understanding of God as a youth. And I was looking for, you know, understanding. I tried to read the Bible myself, and that didn't work without the computer open next to it to try and reference things. And it was very slow and arduous, and I really wasn't getting that much out of it. And I came across Joyce Myers on TV, and I started listening to her interpretation. She would add words into the interpretation of the Bible, but she related it to life.
Yeah.
And she had a miserable life. She had a tough life like me. And, you know, it made sense. So I listened to her, and I got a lot out of that. And I became to see Jesus as a kind, saving, you know, as my savior. And I started to understand that I was loved. I was exactly like I was, with no conditions. I was given grace. You know, I listened to a lot of Christian music and go to a lot of concerts there. And I've gotten a lot of solace with that, a lot of blessings there. And I have come to a place where I understand that this God that I love now loves me, and I can't do any. He's forgiven me for everything I've done before, that I do now, and that I will do in the future.
So one of the things that, you know, so when I was pastor at First Baptist, one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to get to know the people who were using the space, you know, at First Baptist. And so I started to attend different meetings. And one of the things that I came to understand is that some of the most spiritually healthy things that were taking place around First Baptist were taking place at some of these noontime meetings. And it was just beautiful, as people just had a safe place to be able to talk and to share. And in the literature, you can correct me if I get this wrong, but there's a piece of the literature that's shared every single time that you gather together that talks about pursuing spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it just, it, as I was listening to you share your story, right, it's in sharp contrast to what you shared about your upbringing, right? Spirit, you know, the demand for spiritual perfection and the weight that presses upon us as, mm-hmm. as people. And then all of a sudden we feel like we don't measure up. And if we don't measure up, well, then, you know, there's no place for us at the table. And so we exit and we leave. But every time I attend a meeting and that piece gets read, there's a part inside my spirit that just cheers, that just, I want to get up and I want to pretend that I'm at a Phillies game and we just had five home runs. And that's
not last night,
I know. But that's when I want to stand up and cheer and just say, yeah, we strive for spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. That's what it's been, all right? It's been for me. But the the greatest gift of being in this program is watching other people come in broken as I was, as you know, miserable, as down as I was, and watch the lights come on in their eyes, watch the smiles on their faces start to happen, watch them start to get into service, start to help other people, and get that gift. And see, that's the greatest gift of the program that I've seen over the years is that, all right, to watch other people recover. And that keeps me coming back every day, all right? It keeps me in service. It keeps me putting my hand out to the next person that comes in. It took me 15 years in the program to be able to forgive my father, and not only forgive my father, but accept him as an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And a sick person, and love him in that way. Because I had no love for my father. He never told me he loved me, and I never told him that. You know, it was not that type of relationship. And He died, he died a drunk. He died an alcoholic death, which is an ugly death, with me treating him miserably as a dog. I'd get called every time when he needed something, and his landlord was going to throw him out, or, you know, the bar would, didn't pay his bills at the bar, and I'd have to come bail him out. And I treat him like a dog for that. And I owed him an amends for that in death, and which I did. And but I never, it took me 15 years to get to that point where I had melted down, my heart had opened up enough that I could do that. And I'm fine with that now. The peace that I got when I did that was amazing. But what I see in these rooms and with this program is this progress, all right? Not perfection, because nobody's perfect. You know, I believe that God didn't design us to be perfect. He designed us specifically not perfect so that we'll always need him. Yeah. And I believe that because I always will. I always need forgiveness. You know, it's a song that says, that, you know, how many times has God forgiven me today? How many drops of water have fallen in the ocean? And, you know, I hope it's not that many, but it might be some days, I'll tell you.
So some days it feels like that,
some
right?
days it feels like that. I'm in pretty bad shape.
But one of the other gifts that the meetings gave me, right? So my open door policy, everybody would walk past as they were leaving the meeting, and they would speak into my office. See you later, Pastor, one day at a time. See you later, Pastor, one day at a time. You know, I didn't have 20 people do that in a day. And when I first got here, I thought, you know, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. You know, if, you have to have an Excel sheet, you better have a calendar, and you better be planning more than one day at a time. Because if you're not, you're not going anywhere. Like, that's the way I moved, right? That's the way, that's the way I thought. That's the way I approached life. And then in 2016, when I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, all of a sudden my world changed. And it wasn't, it became one day at a time. It became sometimes 1 minute at a time. Mm-hmm. And it was, I remember the day where I was coming out of treatment, and as I was leaving the treatment facility, I was wiped. I had no energy and was really questioning, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to put my body through this? Do I want to go through what this is, what this looks like it's going to be? Because this does not look fun. And I remember walking out the door and saying, okay, one day at a time. One day at a time. And I just started laughing, going, okay, that's what this means. That's what this is. And there are seasons where, yeah, that's what this is. When life is rough, and we're fighting and we're struggling and there are difficult things, one day at a time is really all we need. So, yeah.
Yeah, the concept of that we're taught, all right, and the doctor's opinion, which is the first chapter in our big book, all right, it talks about the concept of disease, all right, that alcoholism, drug addictions are a disease, and that's that's the medical opinion now is that, and we don't think that, right? We're taught that it's a moral disease. It's a, we're weak, or right? We don't have enough willpower. How come you can't do this? How come, with everything that's so good in your life, how come they can't stop drinking? And, why would they do that again? They just had a car accident because they were drinking. They just got arrested. How could they possibly get back out and drink again? There must be really something wrong with that person, all right? They should be locked up or something like that. And the fact is that it is a disease. We need to accept that about ourselves. And when we realize that it is a progressive fatal disease and always fatal, all right, it's the proof is there, the evidence is there, all right. Once I accepted that, all right, myself, I was I was okay with it. You know, how would I treat somebody with cancer? Mm-hmm. You know, how would I feel about that, you know? But in my own case, all right, I can't control, you know, tomorrow hasn't come yet. It doesn't exist. Yesterday's done. I can't change it. Okay, I need to focus on the only place I can do anything about any of this, which is now. Yeah. All right, and I became aware of the power of now. All right, it's actually a book called that, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about when I would get into my head about, you know, tangled up with the future, you know, with what's going to happen, or misery of the past. You know, shame or something that somebody's trying to make me feel about. I look at my feet and I say, okay, you know, where am I right now? Hey, I'm in a room that's heated or air conditioned. Nobody's chasing me. Nobody's pointing a gun at me. There aren't any cops throwing handcuffs on me. You know, I'm not in a hospital bed being told I'm going to die in a couple of minutes. Things are pretty good.
Yeah.
All right. I got to focus on now. And what can I do to make it better and make somebody else's life better? How can I help them? And when I get out of me and start focusing on other people, it all just moves right along. And God takes care of me. Yeah. And I never knew that before. And that's the easiest way to live. I can handle 24 hours a day. All right. Sometimes, like you said, it's only 10 minutes at a time. And when early on in my recovery, it was that. I would look at my watch literally and I'd say, all right, at, you know, it's 10 minutes to 11. All right. If by 11, I still feel like this, I'm going to have to do something. I cannot stand this for another 10 minutes, but I'm going to go till then. And this too shall pass is one of our sayings. And it always did. Came to that 10 minute mark and I was okay. And if it was still feeling shaky, I'd say, okay, you know, give myself an hour. I think I can handle another hour. And that's how it would go. The other thing with pain, same way. You know, I'd be in great pain. I had some issues with that. And same thing. I would think about the pain. I would think, where am I right now? Let me not anticipate where it's going. I know this is going to get much worse. And I'd start focusing on that, and I wouldn't be there. I'd be at a level 5. You know, I'm not at a level 10 right now. So I'd say, okay, I can handle level 5. I can handle this. I'm not at 10. I'm going to focus on that. I'm not going to anticipate it being at 10. Maybe it'll stay here. All right? But let me see. If it does get there, then, you know, let's give it till this period of time. And it never got there.
Yeah.
It never gets that
never
bad.
Never got that bad. Well, Dan, listen, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story and sharing so much of it. It just means a lot to me that you would be willing to share it with us. And for everybody that's listening, you know, you've heard a lot from Dan, and just, you know, look at where you are now, and look at those around you, and how can you serve those around you, and as it's in the service, it's when we get out of our own way, it's when we become less self-focused, that we begin to see the fullness and the completeness of the world, and we begin to see the grace that exists in the world for ourselves and for other people, and all of a sudden a situation that might look bad, it might feel bad, it might be bad, but all of a sudden, when we begin to look at the world and through a different lenses and in a different kind of way, all of a sudden, that situation, it can be transformed. It can be renewed. And that's what we're hoping for. So Dan, just thank you so much for being with us and sharing your story. And until next time, we hope you join us again.
Well, thanks for having me. And hopefully somebody gets helped.